The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 748. It's the 31st of March, 2017. End of the month, end of the first quarter. On the podcast today, I have Jeremy Martin, CEO of Horizonte Minerals, that's HZM, talks about the drill program on their feasibility study at its Tier 1 nickel project in Brazil. I also have Dave Reeves, Managing Director of Keras Resources, that's KRS, discusses their intention to target the high-growth battery market and its applications for cobalt and nickel licenses in West Africa. Plus, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the following stocks, and these are recaps. We've covered these previously, but they've had results since. Manx Telecom, that's M-A-N-X, Parity, P-T-Y, and Cardfractory, C-A-R-D. We also discuss Brexit. Plus, as always, I also have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs on the platform this morning.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, CEO of Horizonte Minerals. That's HZM. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good afternoon. Good to speak to you again.
You too. Where are you in the world at the moment? Last time we spoke, I think you were in Brazil. Where are you at the moment?
I have literally just got back from Brazil, so I'm sitting squarely in London.
Nice. All right. Well, you've had a bit of a busy period there. You know, you've kicked off the feasibility study, and you had a bit of news out yesterday. Before we get to that, just for people not quite aware of what you do, can you explain what Horizonte is all about, please, Jeremy?
Absolutely. We're focused in Brazil, and we are developing a significant nickel project called Araguaia. We've just started a feasibility, and we see this as the next major nickel project to go into production.
Yeah, and it's what's been defined as sort of a Tier 1 project, isn't it?
Yeah, we today have one of the highest grade undeveloped saprolite nickel projects out there. The numbers in the pre-feasibility study show that it sits at the bottom end of the cost curve, and it can make money in the current environment where you're sitting at sort of a 10-year low in terms of the nickel price cycle. So it's a robust asset that will make significant money over the next 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, and that's important, isn't it? Because I know a lot of people are predicting the nickel price will go north from here because we're sort of still bouncing around, not far off multi-year lows. But the fact that you can be profitable at these levels is encouraging, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think nickel today is sort of around $9,500, $9,800 a tonne. It's sort of been moving around this week at. We will sit at the lower range of the cost curve, and we will be able to make money at these prices, and there's very few assets out there that can today. So that's what we've tried to do. We've tried to create a low capital project that works at the low end of the nickel price range. And I think if you look at what most of the banks are looking towards in terms of future nickel pricing, we'll be looking to come into production in sort of 2000, late 19 into 20. And pretty much universally across the board, everybody is looking at nickel prices over sort of $16,000 to $18,000 a ton. And at those levels, we make exceptional money.
Yeah. Okay. And like I said, you're heading towards hopefully production end of 2019, 2020. But before you get that done, you're undertaking a feasibility study, which you are fully funded for. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we raised 9 million sterling in December last year. It was very well supported by our existing cornerstone shareholders, Teck, Canada's largest mining company, Henderson, Richard Griffiths, City Financial, and we were able to get two good institutional names to join that list, JP Morgan and Hargreave Hale. So we have a very strong register and also the cash to develop and complete this feasibility study.
Yeah, I've got to say, that is a very impressive. When I wrote a blog on you, I was very impressed by the shareholder register. They don't come much bigger than JP Morgan, do they, really?
No, I mean, we've got sort of Teck and Glencore on the register, who are sort of two of the largest miners, and then we've got some of the larger institutions with JP Morgan and Henderson. So, yeah, I think for a company of our size, we've got a fairly strong register, and that should give people comfort going forwards.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's cover the recent news here. And you started the drill program. I'm not going to even attempt to pronounce the appointment. It's I can pronounce the first bit. Geotech Reserves do Brazil, and then it's a lot of, is it Portuguese or Spanish there?
Absolutely. Basically, it's Portuguese, and it's basically drilling services. So we won't go into the details behind that. It is quite a wordy name. I think that the sort of key things are that I was down in Brazil 2 weeks ago. We awarded the feasibility contracts, which you and I talked about. I'm very pleased with that. Obviously, Worley Parson being the lead engineer there. We had around 25 people down on site from all the engineering disciplines and the environmental and social for a very good kickoff meeting. This week, we've got a team up in Canada working through the process flow sheet with the Worley Parson team. We've got another team up in Belém, which is the capital of Pará, working with the state environmental agency there. And we're working on getting the installation license, which is the license to allow us to start construction. And yes, yesterday we announced start of drilling. It'll be a short 14 to 1500 meter program. And we will be drilling off areas to do the trial mining, the detailed geotechnical work over the plant site. That will allow the engineers to go ahead and design the foundations, all of the loads, etc., that need to go on the pads for where the plant will sit. And also the drilling for the hydro program to look at the water balances and overall water usage around the mine site. So very busy. And then as we move to April and late April, we'll be starting the trial mining. So we've got a very intensive 4 to 5 month period on the ground on the project.
Yeah, this is when it starts to get real now, isn't it? Actually, drills going into the ground, everything, all different facets of the business coming together and, you know, focused on this feasibility study. So, I mean, it's going to be, hopefully, you're saying, complete by the end of 2017. But this initial drill program, how long does that last then? And when will we get results from that?
Yeah, the initial drill program will be very quick. We should have that complete within 4 to 6 weeks, and we'll start to see results flow in sort of 3 to 4 weeks. We're drilling around the ship there, so 24 hours a day, and the aim is that we get in all of our work. We aim to complete on a very quick turnaround. Obviously, the longer these things run, the longer they cost, so we're keen to get everything complete in a short time frame. All of that data then flows straight through to the engineering, the mining, and the hydro side, and then that's worked up into the feasibility work streams.
Yeah, on a macro level, like you said, you've been to Brazil, you know what it's like there. I know they're recently just coming out of their worst recession on record, and sometimes that is the best time to invest, is it, in stock and shares after a recession. Now, what is the feeling like economically in Brazil? Are they very proactive with trying to get the economy going?
Absolutely. I think Brazil's come out of a very tough 24-month period where we had obviously issues at the political level. We had corruption. We had devaluation of the real, which actually has been very helpful for us. We've now got a stable government in place. We're seeing a lot of inflows of money. We've seen stabilization of the currency. And so I think it is definitely building back into full gear. It's actually been very good for us. We've been still going flat out during that period. A lot of our competition has dropped away. And as a result, for example, with the mines department, with the environmental department, we are now one of the sort of key companies that's getting their attention. And that is very beneficial in terms of moving through the permitting pathway. So actually, it's been a real advantage to us, and we feel that we're very well positioned now for growth in Brazil and also growth in metals and nickel.
Yeah, well, I know, you know, the Brazilian stock market has been one of the best performers, hasn't it, last sort of 6 to 12 months. And we often see this because when you see almost even before the green shoots start coming out to the economy growing, we know the stock market is ahead of everything else and it starts to rally where it's almost 18 months ahead. So that's almost a bit of foresight into the recovery of the economy, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that Brazil's the seventh largest economy in the world. That there's a lot of industry in Brazil. Obviously, it's a big mineral producer, and I think we'll see it go from strength to strength.
Okay, all right. So as far as news, what's the next bit of significant news you're hoping to report here at the Araguaia Project?
I think there's going to be lots of news. There's obviously going to be news from the actual field work on the ground, the drilling, the trial mining, all of the work around that. There's also going to be work on permitting, and there's going to be work on the engineering, which will generate news. So I think it's going to be a very active 6 to 8 months for the company.
Excellent. Jeremy, good to chat to you. One last thing. You know the pack drill here. If someone's listening to this net right now and they think, I like the sound of that, but they're not following you on Box Markets, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, on your page.
I think number one, we've talked about the very strong shareholder base and strong cash position today. Number two, we have one, if not the leading nickel project out there, which is moving through that big value curve cycle from feasibility moving into production. And number three, still sitting nickel prices at a sort of a 10-year low. Our share price is still at a bottom end trading range, and there's a lot of value to go. I mean, I think we're trading at around 2 cents per pound of nickel in the ground. And peer group assets in this sort of range have traded anywhere from 5 to 25 cents a pound of nickel in the ground. So big inherent value we've got to drive into this going forwards.
Marvellous. Jeremy, good to chat to you, and look forward to chatting to you again in the not too distant future when you have some more news out. Thanks very much, Jeremy.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dave Reeves, Managing Director of Keras Resources, KRS ticker. Dave, thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Justin.
And I can sense by the ambience there in the background that you're not in your normal office environment, are you? Where are you at the moment?
No, pounding the pavements of London, trying to get the word out about what we're up to at Keras.
Excellent. Well, you've had an interesting bit of news out, and we'll get to that in a bit. But before we do that, Dave, as always, could you give a brief summary as to what Keras is all about, please?
Yeah, look, Keras has gold as its main value driver, and we're funding our subsidiary through an ASX listing coming up in the next couple of months, which will provide a well-cashed-up gold arm. At the same time, we have a manganese deposit in Togo we're looking at developing in the near term. And we just announced today, along with that manganese and where it can be used in cathodes and batteries, we're going to be adding cobalt and nickel to our suite with a target of specialising in those cathodic materials for batteries, as we see it as a really large value growth area.
Yeah, well, take us through this, because you've applied for cobalt and nickel licences, so take us through exactly why your thought process and the journey here.
For sure. So, you know, as I said, we will have this fully funded gold sub and be looking at getting some cash flow in from our manganese in the not-too-distant future. We're saying, well, what can we also look at? Manganese, when we started looking at batteries, et cetera, we see batteries as one of the highest growth areas for metals and minerals in the next 5 years, with year-on-year growth, you know, surpassing any other material out there. Obviously, graphite and lithium are fairly well known, and a lot of companies are looking at them. But as we looked at the cathode side, which hasn't received as much attention, four of the five main lithium-ion batteries use either manganese and/or cobalt. In the cathodes, and we've got manganese. We think, well, we've got manganese, maybe we should look at cobalt as well. So we started looking around at various cobalt projects and have found a cobalt project not too far away in West Africa from where we operate. We'll obviously give full details once granted. So we've applied for that. All of that's in progress. We've done initial DD checks in the field, etc. Just thought we'd get the word out there that, you know, we're not sitting still, and we are going to be targeting the battery segment through cobalt and manganese exposure.
Yeah, when you see just the fundamental change over the last few years in the way people have been talking about, you know, clean tech and electric batteries and all this stuff and lithium, then it's very wise, really, isn't it, to open up a bit of exposure to this area. It's like you said, it's growing at an alarming rate, and I think it'll come. You know, there will be a tipping point at which point more people will have almost electric cars, or whatever, than actually, you know, petrol or diesel-powered cars. So you've got to look towards the future, haven't you? I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you have a look at what's happening worldwide, you're seeing peak iron ore in China approaching. That's, you know, the bulk starting to suffer there because of peak steel. In Australia, there's hardly any subsidies left on solar, but solar is increasing incrementally year on year as power prices increase. Solar production costs decrease, so you're seeing the renewables really take off, and with those renewables taking off, both in electric vehicles and home storage, off-grid storage, you're seeing the rise of the batteries. And you know, batteries, what they're doing in some of the batteries these days, be it for home or be it for industrial storage, is quite fascinating. I think is revolutionising the world. And it's going to need certain minerals that haven't been at the forte of the mining industry previously, and that's what you've been seeing in graphite and lithium and I think the key component that's missing of that and that people are waking up to now is without a doubt cobalt.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what's the next step here? You've applied for licenses. Do you know how long this will take?
Yeah, look, we're hoping within the next 6 to 8 weeks that should all be granted and we'll be on the ground and starting to get some results going through initial trenching, rock sampling, etc. before we'd look at a limited drill campaign. And I think it's worthwhile just emphasising in cobalt just the sheer value of it. It's doubled in price in the last 6 months, $50,000 a tonne, which is, you know, a very high value product. So if you look at the average grades we've been shipping out on the mineralised zones of 0.8% nickel and 0.2% cobalt, cobalt is actually far more valuable than the nickel component. And that equates to near on 4.5 grams a tonne gold equivalent to give people a feel for what that actually means.
Yeah, wow. Excellent. So exciting stuff, David. Okay, listen, if someone's listening to this and they like the direction you've taken here and they're not following you on Vox, can you give us three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, Dave?
Absolutely. About to have a fully funded, potentially undervalued gold subsidiary. We have near-term production coming through from the manganese and now exposure to the exciting battery world through a cobalt application.
Excellent, Dave. Good to speak to you and hopefully speak again very soon. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ross Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. Ross, thanks for coming back on, fella.
It's a pleasure, Justin. Thank you for having me.
Now, we saw the letter. It was 6 pages long. And when Donald Tusk got up, he said, I saw it on the news. He said, here it is, 6 pages. I don't know if he expected more or less than that. I don't know what... Did he want more? I thought it was quite long. I thought, really?
I don't know. I mean, I think, to be fair, that probably tells you what you need to think about Brexit in investment terms, at least in the short term, which is you can't get too hung up about it because the politicians and the diplomats don't know how this is going to work out. So basing any short-term trades or picks on second-guessing what's going to happen is really going to be the devil's work. So if you're a long-term investor, I know there's going to be lots of noise over the next 2 years as the clock ticks down to the deadline, but in the end, you're probably just better off sticking to your disciplines. In the end, it's corporate cash flows and it's valuation that determine your returns from your investments. And yes, I'm sure that in the long run, Brexit may affect certain industries or certain stocks, but given that we don't know that right now, and given that you can still identify companies with strong competitive positions, good management teams and strong balance sheets that won't be affected by Brexit, stick to your knitting is probably my best idea on that one. And don't get too hung up on the noise, because if the politicians don't know what's going to happen, you don't know what's going to happen. And I could say the same for the US as well with the Donald, because obviously he's not quite getting things his own way at the moment either.
No, exactly. And just, I find it very odd is that, as far as Britain's concerned, it seems like we want a trade deal that will benefit business, you know, or not hinder business anyway. And it seems to me the politicians may get in the way, on the European side of it all, may get in the way of that. You know, they may put politics first before business. Do you think that's the case?
It's not impossible. I mean, again, you know, there are. I mean, although nobody's left the European Union. Greenland did actually leave the EEC in 1985. It got home rule from Denmark in 1979, voted to leave the EEC, the European Economic Community, in 1982, and it took 3 years for them to reach a deal with the EEC just about fishing rights. So, you know, although we've got this 2-year deadline, you know, I suspect that it is going to be a pretty complex, tangled set of negotiations. And yeah, again, one of the reasons why you shouldn't necessarily bet or invest on what politicians are going to do is that they may do things out of their own vested interests rather than what necessarily makes sense economically or for business.
Yeah, so like I said, it's 2 years is a long time, but it's a short period to negotiate. And is it a case that if any one country in the EU, you know, it's not happy with something, then it throws a spanner in the works, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because it has to be a unanimous decision across the other 27 members. I mean, in theory, the 27, if they do it unanimously, can agree to extend that 2-year deadline.
Okay.
They can also, if, and I don't think for a second this is the way the wind's blowing, if the government were to decide to abandon Article 50 and actually, you know, the triggering of Article 50 can actually be revoked with the approval of the other 27, and I don't think that's the way it's going at all. So there is room for manoeuvre here, but again, everything that has to be done has to be done by a 27 strong unanimous vote, which is, as we all know, you get 27 people in a room talking about football, the category, let alone anything else.
Well, two people in a room, Mr. Hardwick.
Well, in fact, frankly, yeah, to be fair. So, in that respect, you know, everybody's got, you know, as we all know, opinions are like backsides. Everybody's got one, and it does tend to slow things down.
Exactly. Okay. Let's go from the uncertainty of the macro to the uncertainty of the micro.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what are you looking at stocks wise this week, Russ?
Well, I thought what we do, because we've rattled through quite a lot of stocks over the last sort of 6, 8, 10 weeks, is just do a trio of updates on companies that we flagged previously, all of whom have had results in the past 2 or 3 weeks. So we're going to look at Manx Telecom, Parity, and Card Factory.
Okay, let's go for it then. Let's go for Manx.
Okay, so let's go with Manx. I mean, we first discussed this one back in February, and since then the share price has done absolutely nothing, which frankly is kind of what I was expecting and hoping for. The shares have just gone sideways because, as I flagged, 196p, because as I flagged the AIM quoted company, it's really there as a dividend yield play, although there is potential for some gentle earnings growth going forwards. The full year results came out the 15th of March. Revenue's at 1.5%, pre-tax profit flat, cash flow up 5%, net debt flat. I mean, none of it's, you know, man bites dog stuff by any means, but that's one of the reasons why I was, you know, flagging the company. The balance sheet's good. Interest covers more than 6 times, so you're not going to get into any trouble there. And, you know, there are some signs going forwards with a small acquisition, the rollout of 4G mobile telecom systems and roaming agreements, improved work on its customer relationship management and billing software, and also a connectivity deal with China Unicom, that the top line may start to move up a little bit more and profits may start to move up a little bit, particularly as management are keeping control of costs. But the key news here was the increase in the dividend from 10.4 to 10.9 pence a share. That's a 5.5% dividend yield covered 1.2 times by earnings, which for a dependable utility is fine. And if earnings start to creep up, it could just pull the dividend with it, or certainly at least give anybody who's nervous about the cover a little bit more comfort. But what you've got here is a well-run company, obviously a strong competitive position given it's the kind of de facto provider in the Isle of Man, with a decent balance sheet, management who aren't taking any chances, that's just chucking out plenty of cash, and for income hunters, rolling out a nice dividend.
Yeah, and it's in a gentle sort of downtrend a little bit, but it doesn't seem to want to go below 195. Anytime it goes below that, it sort of pops back up a little bit. So it looks like a good support level there on the chart anyway.
Touch wood, yeah. I mean, again, it's not the most thrilling of charts. You know, you're not going to get not a lot of volatility, but again, that's the type of business that it is. And certainly anybody who's looking to trade a stock or looking for vol, then they aren't going to latch into this one at all. So like all stocks, it isn't going to suit everybody's strategies, goals, target returns, or investment style. But for steady income hunters looking to trouser a dividend every year without hopefully too much stress, you know, this one still looks to fit the bill after a solid set of full year results.
Marvellous. Next one was it Parity you mentioned?
Parity, PTY on AIM again, yeah. And this one actually has got a bit of a wiggle on since we first talked about it in February. It's gone from 9.8p to around just over 11, and it's just come back a little bit after the numbers. But again, in stark contrast to Manx, this is still quite a high risk angle play, potentially high risk, potentially high reward. And that's because the balance sheet is still by no means pristine. There's, you know, the net debt, the good news was net debt came down last year from 7.4 to 4.4 million, which is fantastic news. Mm-hmm. The pension deficit, though, is 1.9 million. So you've got 6.3 million of liabilities against 6.5 million of equity. So you've got a balance sheet that's not as healthy as you'd like it to be. But a 15 million debt facility was extended out to 2018 on a lower interest rate.
Yeah.
So the management team have bought themselves some breathing space. And in terms of the corporate turnaround story that's brewing here, potentially, certainly boss Alan Rommel had quite a few things to point to. Remember, what we had here was a company that had gone on a failed acquisition spree, making thin margins with a weak balance sheet. Well, the balance sheet's still weak, but it's getting better. The margins have improved a little bit from 1.2 to 1.9%. And management is reshaping the portfolio. There's a non-core business being put up for sale, as we discussed a few weeks ago. And the focus on the consulting business rather than the lower margin recruiting business is paying off. Consulting revenues were up 20, recruitment revenues were up 10. The company went from a loss to a pre-tax profit of 960 grand. And again, they generated cash and began to pay the debt down. I think, you know, lower debt means lower risk, potentially means higher equity value or higher share price. And you still have a company with an £11.5 million market cap making £92 million of sales.
Yeah,
so if they can get the margins up to anything that's vaguely credible, you've got a potentially cheap stock here. Now, there's been a new non-executive director brought in who actually used to be the company's finance director in the 1990s. So he knows the company backwards. There's a new non-executive chairman coming, John Connolly. He's former Net Dimensions, which I think has just been sold, former Esure Global, and he also used to be the chief executive officer of Scion, if you remember that name, from way back in the UK tech days. Do you know what it stood for, by the way?
No.
Potter Scientific Industries or nothing.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, after Potter, the bloke who set it up. Yeah, that's what Scion used to stand for. Anyway, as an aside, so John Connolly's got a pretty good CV. He's been brought in as a non-executive chairman. Alan Rommel's in there as the CEO from 2 years ago. He got a new CFO in. So these guys do look to be giving, you know, be prepared to give Parity a bit of a shake-up. Interest cover's improved. The balance sheet risk is coming down. And if they can start to get the earnings up, you still may have a cheap stock on your hands. I mean, I'm sure it's not going to be a straightforward ride. Turnarounds very rarely are. But for the moment, at least, you've got new management team, right ideas, and the early signs are quite promising, judging by the full year results.
Yeah, they seem to be focusing on the problem areas, don't they? And like I said, if they can make, even doing basic maths, if they can get 10% margin, clear margin on that 91 million, then that's a good little, they are undervalued. Obviously, you've got debt there, they're clearing that down there. Yeah, marvellous. Yeah. Okay, what's the last one there?
So the last one's Card Factory, which isn't strictly a small cap. I know it's got a 900 million market cap and it's FTSE 250, but it's kind of small to mid. Wakefield-based firm, results out on the 28th of March, and very similar story to Manx. You know, momentum jockeys and growth hunters are going to turn their noses up at it and just walk straight away. Income hunters are probably going to give it a bit of a cuddle and say, you know, for the greetings card and gift wrapping company, because the dividend is the story here as well. Sales up 4, operating profit down 4, pre-tax down 1, nothing desperately exciting there. But again, ordinary dividend up 7% to 9.1p. That's enough for a 3.3% yield all on its own, twice covered by earnings. But as we flagged back in February when we first talked about it, a 15p special dividend popped up there. That's a total dividend of 24.1p or a 9% yield. And boss Karen Hubbard has already flagged there will be another special distribution for fiscal 2018. Again, no promises, no guarantees. It's going to be the same as the last 2 years at 15p. But there's plenty of cash coming out of the company. And some of the sort of strategic decisions that relatively new boss Karen Hubbard's taking, you know, improving product quality, rolling out stores, cutting costs and getting the online business going. You know, this company isn't going to grow very quickly, if at all much, but those initiatives mean that they could sneak up a bit of market share. You know, it's a pretty steady market. People still like to send things, even if, you know, that you can use moonpig.com and all those other services. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty consistent business. It's got a decent balance sheet. It generates dollops of cash. And I think it's a pretty fair chance over time, a lot of that surplus cash is going to come back to shareholders in special dividends and make, you know, even the 3.3% yield twice covered is pretty fine. But, you know, you could end up with a dividend yield 7, 8, 9%, which, let's face it, in these times, for income hunters, is probably something that may catch their eye.
Yeah. And as far as the chart, if you put a chart out and put the 200-day moving average, which I know a lot of people look at, it literally just whacked its head on that. It went from it hit the bottom at 240, then around 280, it hit this, and it refused or failed to close above that level. And so you'd say if it does that in the future, maybe it's headed for an uptrend, but it's definitely having a trading in a range here, 240, 280.
It could well be that kind of stock again, given that it isn't going to grow that quickly. I think probably, if you are looking to nip about, the chart might be a good guide for you. Again, as an income hunter, you may be inclined to just pop it in a bottom drawer and, you know, farm the dividends 2 or 3 times a year.
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous, Russ, thanks so much. Good as always.
It's a pleasure.
And speak next week, fella.
I look forward to it. Take care now.
Okay, it's time for the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, Blenheim Natural Resources, BNR. At 4, it's a new one, new entry, not seen this before, Intelligent Energy Holdings, IEH. At 3, Feedback, FDBK. At 2, it's always there, Ascent Resources, AST. And number 1 most followed company on Vox Markets last 24 hours was Sirius Minerals, SXX. Yes, I'm serious. Also, top 5 most liked RNSs on Vox Markets website this morning. At 5, Codal Minerals, KOD, Holdings and Company. At 4, Pantheon Resources, PANR, interim results. At 3, 7 Digital, 7 Dig, Holdings and Company. I think Myton Group there has gone to above 10% there. At 2, Premier Africa Minerals, that's PREM, conversion of directors' fees into equity. And number 1, by far and away, the most liked RNS on Vox Markets this morning, came from Ascent Resources, most followed company on Vox Markets, AST, and that was the IPPC permit update. Thanks for listening. That's it for the podcast. Hopefully, there may be a weekend podcast, but I'm out and about. I'm in Wales at the moment, so if I can catch up with Pete and Steve, that'll be done. In the meantime, muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.